Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
3 days into the assault in Marja, Afghanistan.
Clear as many cop houses as possible and push up.
All right, that's what I was saying. Hey, they could be trying to draw our attention to that side anyways.
Thousands of NATO and Afghan forces making a slow, determined push, expanding the area under their control, turning back attacks from insurgents they describe as desperate.
I think it's going very well. I think it's only day two. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but we're optimistic that we're on timeline, maybe a little bit ahead of timeline.
Small fights in fields of alfalfa and opium, step by slow step across irrigation canals and dusty roads. The Marja offensive continues. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's President's Day, Monday, February 15th. The takeaway for me is, you know, Todd Zwillick, Brigadier General Nary Nicholson. We just heard him there being very cautiously optimistic. And you have to wonder, could it be that the cautious optimism is justified? We're going to find out.
We're going to find out. A couple of more days to go in this offensive before we have any real data on that. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. As we've just been hearing, day three in the Battle of Marja in Afghanistan.
Clear as many cop houses as possible and push up.
U.S. Marine and Afghan units press deeper into the city, facing sporadic rocket and mortar fire and keeping a watchful eye out for IEDs or improvised explosive devices. It's a perilous slog for the soldiers. One report says it takes 9 hours to clear a single mile in Marja. Yesterday, the offensive suffered a setback when an errant American missile hit a compound crowded with civilians, killing at least 12 there. General Stanley McChrystal apologized to the Afghan president for the incident.
Our partner, the BBC, is reporting from Afghanistan this morning that the threat of IEDs is worse than NATO commanders anticipated and has slowed the offensive. The BBC's security correspondent Frank Gardner is at NATO headquarters in Kandahar, southern Afghanistan.
Taliban insurgents have planted even greater numbers than predicted, slowing the advance of U.S. forces in the area around Marja. Those insurgents that have chosen to stay and fight are believed to be concentrated in Marja. The assessment of NATO intelligence officers is that insurgent resistance to Operation Mushtarak is disjointed and in pockets. They believe the Taliban may be holding off from launching attacks for the next few days while they wait to see if NATO and its Afghan government allies are staying or leaving.
Pentagon numbers show the use of IEDs has more than doubled from a year ago.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is drifting towards a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says sanctions are needed against particular elements in Iranian society.
Those enterprises controlled by the Revolutionary Guard, which we believe is in effect supplanting the government of Iran.
Now, later today, Secretary Clinton heads to Saudi Arabia, where she's expected to press for more international pressure on China to impose sanctions on Iran.
The U.S. military is scaling back its aid to Haiti. About 13,000 troops now remain on or near the island. That's down from 20,000 2 weeks ago. And the Port-au-Prince airport will reopen to commercial flights on Friday. Every Roman Catholic bishop from Ireland will meet with the Pope one-on-one in the Vatican today. Bishop John Duffy, a spokesman for the Irish Bishops' Conference, said Ireland's bishops will tell the Pope what they knew and did about clergy sex abuse.
I think the casualty in all of this has been the truth, and we do accept that the fullness of truth must come out. Everything must be laid on the table.
An investigation last year showed church leaders in Ireland spent decades protecting child abuse priests from the law. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are down, European indices are up, Wall Street markets are closed for President's Day. And we're going to be talking later in the show about autism. Health studies often contradict each other. What are the facts separating facts from fiction in autism?
We're also following the Winter Olympics all morning, which got off to a sad start when a loser died during practice on Friday. We're looking for your takeaway. Are the Winter Olympics getting too fast or too extreme, too dangerous? That's 8778-MY-TAKE, or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Just a few minutes, we get an update on the assault in Marja in Afghanistan. That's coming up.
Good Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, but this is not John Hockenberry. Todd Zwillick is filling in for John all this week. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Celeste.
We have the latest details coming out of Afghanistan. U.S., British, and Afghan forces have begun day three of the assault on the Taliban stronghold in Marja in the Helmand province in the southern part of the country. And for the latest details, we turn to Jean McKenzie. She's a correspondent for the Global Post in Kabul, Afghanistan. She's been getting news from her reporters out in the field in Helmand province. Jean, what are the latest details on the offensive?
Well, we're hearing that the Taliban are winding down a bit on their defense, on their resistance, although the spokesperson is saying that the Taliban will resist to the end, that they're not going to let the foreign and Afghan forces into Marja. They obviously cannot hold out for very long against a force of 15,000 troops. But they have surrounded the area with mines. We're hearing up to 70,000 IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, have been laid in and around Marja, which is a fairly limited district. It's not a large area.
We've been hearing that the NATO and Afghan forces are moving very, very slowly. Is that because they're coming up against more IEDs than they expected?
Absolutely. We heard from one doctor inside Marja that just 200 meters in front of his house, he had seen the Taliban laying 35 mines that were interconnected. So that can do quite a bit of damage to a force that encounters them. They're going to have to move very, very slowly because with a very long run-up to this operation, the Taliban have had ample time to put down their weapons, to put down the IEDs.
Also with us this morning is Jeffrey Dressler. He's an expert on Afghanistan at the Institute for the Study of War. He focuses in particular on military strategy. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
I wanted you to listen to this particular clip of tape from Lieutenant Ryan Engel. He's with the Lima Company.
3-6, Lima Company. We came into the northwest area of Marja and took this intersection of the canals. It was limited resistance, much less, no real resistance, much less than was expected. Or we did find several IEDs and bombs and things like that.
Why are we experiencing less resistance than expected in Marja?
Well, I actually don't think that it's a surprise to people who are familiar with the operations that the Taliban have mounted in the past. They typically do not confront a large-scale military force head-on. What they do is exactly what you're seeing. It's a lot of asymmetric hit-and-run attacks, primarily with IEDs and mines. And so this is really much very much in character for what we've seen in the past. And I think that you know, as I heard you mention earlier, that certainly is going to account for the pace, the slow pace of the operation for the Marines and Afghan troops.
Jeffrey, address the 12 Afghan civilians were killed by an American rocket strike that missed its intended target yesterday. The whole purpose, the military had said, of publicizing this in advance was to, number one, get civilians to safe haven if they possibly could, and to allow the Taliban to cross over. So what does this rocket strike that killed 12 civilians, how does that hurt this offensive?
Well, I mean, there's no question that it's always a tragic event whenever innocent lives are lost. It's my understanding that what happened was it was a malfunction in the rocket technology that caused it to misfire and kind of go off target, and it struck a civilian compound. And I think the reports coming out are suggesting between 10 and 12 civilians were killed. And so, you know, obviously they've tried to do everything that they can to prevent civilian casualties, and that absolutely has been the number one concern, and I know that they'll continue to operate that way. Unfortunately, sometimes when you have that much combat power in a very small area, sometimes things like this can happen. But it's definitely going to be incumbent upon the tribal elders and the newly appointed district leaders who are going to go in shortly to explain to the population, okay, you know, here's what we're here to do. This is why we launched the operation, and we are here to bring you things that you want. And so hopefully they'll be understanding in that regard.
Jean McKenzie, have you heard any response from the, in terms of what the civilian response are to these casualties? I know that the United States has apologized to Hamid Karzai. What are the people of Afghanistan saying?
Well, of course, there's going to be a very angry reaction to this. No matter what the excuses are, you cannot expect that you're going to be able to conduct an operation of this size without civilian casualties. No matter how hard you try, accidents are going to happen. Bombs are going to land on the wrong houses, or rockets, as we see, have gone off course. But in addition to the outright civilian casualties, we've heard that up to 900 families, and that would be numbered in the thousands, 4,000 or 5,000 people, are now displaced. They're on the move. They're going to Las Cargas. They have no shelter. They have no food. This is also causing quite a negative reaction from the people of Helmand.
Jean McKenzie, this is Todd Zwillick here. What concern are you hearing from the troops if they're encountering light resistance at this point, that the Taliban have simply melted into Pakistan and will come back to fight another day when it's more advantageous for them?
I think, of course, that is a concern. They don't necessarily have to have melted into Pakistan. Much more likely, they are melting back into the population. It's very difficult to tell a Taliban from a farmer from a shopkeeper. So chances are that they will just lay down their arms. They will wait for things to calm down, and then they will start, as Jeffrey Dressler pointed out, asymmetric warfare against the troops once they have stopped the active offensive.
Jeffrey Dressler, I wanted to play for you this clip from NATO spokesman Mark Sedwill.
I can't yet say how long it will take for this military phase to get to the point where we can bring in the civilian support from the Afghan government. We hope that will happen quickly.
So we assume this offensive, as we said, is going to be slow and steady, but when it finishes, Janitor Stanley McClistro said we're bringing in government in a box. Is that going to be the hardest part of this, is what comes after they've secured the territory?
I think that's going to be really the marker of success here, not necessarily the military phase, but what these local governance elements, really the Afghan face that needs to be on this operation, come in and what they're able to accomplish. And so I think that we'll look to that over the coming months to see exactly how this thing's going to play out. The good news is we've done this before, even as recent as the past 6 to 9 months, and so we do have experience in that respect. So that's absolutely correct.
Okay, Jeffrey Dressler is an Afghanistan expert at the Institute for the Study of War. He focuses on military strategy, especially in the Helmand province, which is where the Marja offensive is going on now. Jean McKenzie is a correspondent for the Global Post. She joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Thanks to both of you. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
There's been a major train crash in Belgium today. Nearly 20 people have died after a head-on collision between two commuter trains in Brussels. There was no word on the cause of the crash, which happened during the morning rush hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is traveling to Saudi Arabia today. She wants the Saudi rulers to help persuade the Chinese to take a tougher stand against Iran over its nuclear program. Secretary Clinton spoke earlier in Qatar.
If the Iranian government wants the respect of the international community, it must respect the rights of its own people.
Battling each other on the airwaves yesterday on the Sunday shows, Vice President Joe Biden and former Vice President Dick Cheney. He's criticizing the Obama administration's counterterrorism efforts while ignoring what the Bush administration did.
The Christmas Day bomber was treated the exact way that he suggested that the shoe bomber was treated. Absolutely the same way. Under the Bush administration, there were three trials in military courts. Two of those people are now walking the streets.
So that's the current vice president criticizing the former vice president on ABC's This Week. Dick Cheney said that all terrorist attacks must be treated as an act of war and that all options, including waterboarding, must be available to interrogators.
Eric Holder, for example, the attorney general, who still insists on thinking of terror attacks against the United States as criminal acts as opposed to acts of war.
A new twist in the child trafficking scandal in Haiti. The Dominican man who's acting as legal advisor to the 10 jailed Americans is accused of running an international sex trafficking ring. An arrest warrant was issued for him on Saturday. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for takeouts on the top stories that we're following all week. I'm Todd Zwillick, in all week for John Hockenberry, who's out. I'm here with Celeste, of course. First up, we turn to the White House, where President Obama plans to have an official meeting with the Dalai Lama in the map room in the White House. Now, in the world of diplomatic protocol, that's somehow less important than a meeting in the Oval Office. But the only problem is that a meeting with Tibet's spiritual leader is definitely going to enrage the Chinese just the same, regardless of which room of the White House it's in. And this is all at a time when the president really needs China China's support. Well, here with more is Lynn Sweet. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist for AOL's Politics Daily. She's been following the story. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
Lynn, how long has this meeting been in the works? The Dalai Lama was in Washington a few months ago, right?
He was. He's been in the United States twice since Obama has been president. This visit Thursday will be his third time in the United States in the Obama presidency. The meeting has been in the works since September, when Obama sent senior advisor Valerie Jarrett over to Dar es Salaam, India, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile. He's lived there since 1959, and on that September visit, she invited him to the United States.
So on the last visit, I remember the president did not meet with the Dalai Lama, and some human rights groups were upset about that. Now he is meeting with the Dalai Lama. The Chinese, of course, are outraged, but this all kind of smacks of sort of diplomatic theater. They knew this meeting was coming. Okay, China, you be outraged. We'll do our things. Let's not let anything derail. Am I reading too much into it?
Well, the timing is everything. One of the messages that the White House was sending to the Dalai Lama in September was that the meeting can take place after the president has been in China. So the China visit occurred in November. So that timeline, I think, speaks for itself. The Dalai Lama gets an invitation to the White House in September. He's in the United States in October, does not go to the White House. Then Obama goes to China in November, talks to the Chinese, explains his position, says that the relationship is can handle this, and the meeting is Thursday.
All very well choreographed so far. We'll see if the Chinese play their part later on in the week. Thank you, Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist for AOL's Politics Daily in Washington.
Our next takeout comes from the Olympic Village in Vancouver, British Columbia, where sports writer John Branch is covering the Olympic Games for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Can you kind of bring us up to speed on what happened with the Olympics over the weekend, both the tragic and the triumphant?
Sure. A couple of the storylines. First of all, the tragic is the death of a luge athlete from Georgia on the luge track. And as he came to the very last corner of that track, was upended and went off the track and was killed. It's the first death of an athlete at the Olympics, of an athlete during training or at the competition itself since 1964. Certainly not the way the Olympics wanted to come off. Last night, a cheerier note for the Canadians and the Vancouver Organizing Committee was the first gold medal ever won by a Canadian on Canadian soil. This is the third Olympics for the Canadians to host. And last night, an athlete named Alex Bilodeau won a gold medal in moguls. So it'll be a big celebration.
Yeah, and probably a lot of people collecting on their office pools on when that was going to happen, right?
Exactly. That has been being watched for several days now, the first few days of the Olympics, and he now will be a name that Canadians, I think, school children will never forget.
Okay, John Branch is a sports writer for our partner, the New York Times.
Now for our next takeout, we head to the waiting room.
I never really thought about health plan until I got sick.
And suddenly I have some health problems.
A lot of people that need help like me. I'm not the only one.
The healthcare reform debate has gone relatively quiet in Washington, at least for now, as the White House and Democrats try to work out a new plan and make some nods of bipartisanship to Republicans. But far away from the halls of Congress, the conversation about what's right and what's wrong with healthcare rages on. We've been dropping in on those conversations regularly thanks to a project called The Waiting Room. It's a film and a web and social media project documenting life in the waiting room of Highland Hospital, which is a county facility in Oakland, California. First, we check in with Robert Templeton, who is with his family members at the hospital.
My daughter-in-law broke her foot, and I took off of work to bring her here. She does not have health insurance. Her foot is broken, and she's still sitting there waiting. And there's another lady in a wheelchair over there who's been here since we've been here, over an hour and a half, and you can see the pain on her face, and she's not being waited on.
This project also features moments of beauty in a place where people are often experiencing misery and boredom or impatience. Here's Wanda Gorey, a housekeeper at Highland Hospital. She says faith has helped her enjoy her job. In this moment, she decided to sing to the waiting patients.
Why should I feel discouraged? And why should the shadows
You can watch videos of the waiting room and learn more about the project at thetakeaway.org. And of course, we always want to hear about your experiences with doctors and hospitals as the health reform debate rages on. That's also at thetakeaway.org. You know, Celeste, I cover this debate in Washington, and as much as it rages on, the people I cover really probably don't have a sense, a true sense of what people go through in the waiting room trying to get care for that broken leg when they don't have insurance or that child who's sick.
And I think that's part of the issue, is trying to help the people in Washington understand what it's like on the ground. Also, understanding what it's like on the ground, we're going to talk later about family, as we do every Monday. And we're going to talk about, how does your family make sense of autism when it seems like health studies contradict themselves? We have the straight facts for you later this hour. We're also following the Winter Olympics all morning long. Got off to kind of a sad start, as we talked about, when a luger died during practice on Friday. And we're looking for your takeaway. Are the Winter Olympics getting too fast? Are they too extreme? Are they trying to get audience members by being too extreme? Are they too dangerous? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to the website, thetakeaway.org.
How do you go down market in terms of age without making it so dangerous that it's bad for the athletes? You know, coming up, we're also going to talk about what to expect from the week's news. It's Monday. It's The Agenda with the New York Times and the BBC. It's in a few minutes. Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. All this week, coming up, we take a look at the week ahead in news. It's The Agenda for Mondays. That's in a few minutes. Right now, let's check on top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. It's day three in the battle for Marja in Afghanistan.
As many cop houses as possible.
As U.S. Marines and Afghan units press deeper into the city, they're meeting only light resistance. We're hearing their biggest worry right now is thousands of mines and IEDs the Taliban has hidden throughout the city. That makes for slow going for NATO troops, with one report saying it takes 9 hours to clear 1 mile. Still, this Army corporal says the mission is clear.
Ready to get rid of the Taliban and give the people of Marja their freedom back.
So far, one American Marine has been killed in the assault. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is moving towards a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government.
Every Roman Catholic bishop in Ireland will meet with the Pope one-on-one at the Vatican today, talking about the years of sex abuse by the Irish clergy. Bishop John Duffy says the Pope has been clued in for a long time.
Even before he became Pope at all, that he had access to the documentation, that he knew exactly what was in the documentation.
An investigation last year showed church leaders in Ireland spent decades protecting child abuse priests from the law. Japan's economy grew by a better-than-expected 1% last quarter. That means Japan remains the world's second-largest economy, although China is closely behind and expected to overtake Japan soon. And at the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak finally ended. Alexander Bilodeau took home the gold in the men's moguls. He was winning the country's first ever Winter Olympic gold on their home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stand cheering for them.
So far, the U.S. leads the medal count with 6, followed by Germany and France. Checking in on the markets, Asian markets are down. European indices are up, though. Wall Street closed in the United States today for President's Day. That's a look at some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Hey, what's happening?
Our government.
Issues that are of mutual interest.
Criminal acts as opposed to acts of war.
Working through questions.
Carrying forward this important work.
It's Monday morning, and that means it's time to check out what's on the agenda for the week. Joining us is Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Rob Watson, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC, over in London. Marcus, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Marcus, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she's continuing her trip to the Middle East this week. She spoke today at the U.S. Islamic World Forum and had very strong words for the Iranian government. We just heard about it in the headlines. She says that they're becoming a military dictatorship. Listen to this.
I fear that the rise of influence and power by the Revolutionary Guard poses a very direct threat to everyone.
She's also threatened greater costs to the Iranian regime if it does not comply with nuclear inspections and our desires for their nuclear program. Marcus, what is the Secretary of State doing? Is she isolating Iran, or trying to strengthen ties with the rest of the Muslim world, or a combination of both?
That's a great point, Todd. It's actually both. It's interesting what she really is at risk of this week, and it's not just the Secretary of State who's at risk, but even the President as he meets with the Dalai Lama, and we'll talk about later on. The administration is at risk this week of kind of highlighting American impotence in the world, and the fact that even though it's been a year since President Obama came to office with great hopes for foreign policy, we actually have not seen a great deal of progress on any of these really important fronts. And even in Afghanistan, we're seeing this is the most serious offensive we've ever had in Afghanistan this week in 8 years of war. So this, too, is a test of the administration's ability to change facts on the ground in a way that the previous administration never did. And that's what we're going to see in the Middle East this week with Secretary of State Clinton. The fact is, Iran, it's a military dictatorship as she's declared. Well, what are we going to do about that? And it's not clear we can do a whole lot. When she talks about the cost, greater cost, she's talking about an increased sanctions. And it's not even clear we can get that. And so the enjeu here is really the administration look a little stronger and a little more effective than they have in the past.
Rob Watson of the BBC, Marcus Mabry suggests that the time is ripe for some tough talk from the administration. It seems that Secretary Clinton talking about a military dictatorship in Iran is tailor-made for the Saudis, who are traditional enemies of the Iranians.
Absolutely, although I'm going to disappoint everyone by rather boringly agreeing with Marcus 100%.
Oh, hey, why not?
This does really sort of show up the impotence, if you like, or potentially the impotence. But I guess I'd want to see it as another way. You know, I remember there were lots of people around, certainly around Europe and some in the Middle East, who thought, phewy, thank goodness George W. Bush is gone. Now we can get on with solving some of these dreadful problems. And you get to see that the real issue that's out there is not so much who's in the White House, but just that there are an awful lot of problems that are very, very difficult to deal with, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or whoever you are. And this really reinforces it, and specifically on Saudi Arabia. Look, lots of Iran's neighbors realize that it's a threat. Lots of them were just dying for the nuclear issue to go away. But when you actually confront them and say, what are you going to do about it? Well, then you get the difficulties.
Rob Watson of the BBC, you mentioned the White House, and I want to move on to China, if we could, and the international sort of reaction to the president meeting with the Dalai Lama, specifically the Chinese. Now, this visit, the president going to be meeting with the Dalai Lama in the White House later this week, has been planned for a long time. Of course, the Chinese outrage is mounting right on cue. It's hard to imagine that this is a surprise for anyone. So how should we interpret the president's meeting with the Dalai Lama and the Chinese outrage over said meeting on the international stage?
Well, as you say, it's pretty much according to script, isn't it? Look, in international terms, the way countries like Britain and others in the European Union see it, that they're cutting Obama some slack here because they think, okay, you know, he's tried what everyone wanted him to do. Let's try being a bit nice to China. Let's try being a bit nice to North Korea and Iran, and let's try pressing the reset button with Russia. The very fact that he's tried those things and doesn't seem to have got a huge amount to date out of it means that everyone's right back on the script. Okay, well, you've got to see the Dalai Lama. You've got to do other things. You've got to be tough on Iran.
All right. Well, let's listen to Press Secretary Robert Gibbs talking about this very issue earlier this week.
We can agree on issues that are of mutual interest, but we also have a mature enough relationship that we know that two countries on this planet are not always going to agree on everything, and we'll have those disagreements.
Okay, Marcus Mabry, the dynamic of poking China with the stick a little bit when you have to over the Dalai Lama is clear. But what does the president have to gain, do you think, from holding this meeting? Why does he feel he has to do it?
Well, he has to do it because he has to show that the United States still cares, although we care most of all, and it's increasingly clear in our relationship with China about our economic relationship with China, which is a mutually assured destruction, some would say, but certainly a mutually mutually beneficial relationship. They take our debt when no one else. They take it in great quantities, and we take their product. They're still export-dependent economy. We take their product. So that's the most important thing about the relationship between these two countries. At the same time, the President of the United States, especially a Democratic president, especially given how much the Republican president before him did this, must underline how much the United States continues to care about the rights of minorities and religious minorities.
He has a political debate that demands this.
Absolutely. There's no other choice. Again, the last administration did so much in this regard, criticizing China on these issues, that he can't do any less.
All right, Marcus Mabry in the New York Times, I have to get your take on this little battle that's going, the battle of the vice presidents, Dick Cheney and the current Vice President Joe Biden going at each other on the Sunday shows on terrorism. Let's give Dick Cheney his say first.
It's the mindset that concerns me, John. I think it's very important to go back and keep in mind the distinction between handling these events as criminal acts, which is the way we did before 9/11, and then looking at 9/11 and saying this is not a criminal act, not when you destroy 16 acres of Manhattan, kill 3,000 Americans, blow a big hole in the Pentagon. That's an act of war.
All right. Now, the vice president shot back and said that Dick Cheney's trying to be entitled to his own facts. What do you make of this battle?
Well, this is exactly the same criticism that the Republicans made against John Kerry when he was running against George W. Bush. The Democrats see it as a legal battle. The Republicans see it as an act of war. There's not a whole lot to it other than the politics and the rhetoric that Cheney's pursuing, but the Republicans have had some success with it in the past.
These two seem to like going at each other. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Rob Watson, BBC correspondent, joined us from Bush House in London. Thanks to you both.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry this week. So they strut around the floor. You could say strut with some of these breeds. Perfectly groomed fur, white teeth, meticulously polished nails. It's the dogs at the Westminster Dog Show. They're also staying at one of the city's prime hotels there in Pennsylvania.
No barking.
Yeah, I'm assuming they don't get a mint on their pillows since chocolate is bad for dogs. But joining us to tell us what they do get is Jerry Grimek. He works at the hotel and he serves as the doggy concierge during the dog program. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning. That's right. I'm in charge of pooch relations.
That's right. There could be worse jobs. But let me play you this tape. This is the sound of your lobby at your hotel.
I was totally wrong.
That is the New York's Hotel Pennsylvania. So that's music to your ears, right, Jerry?
That's right. And I think they're just ordering extra pillows for the room. I think that's what I translate lightly.
So these dogs get literally red carpet treatment as soon as they come into your hotel. Can you give us an idea of what you do for these dogs?
Well, as soon as they walk in, you have me, the doggy concierge, greeting them. They get a commemorative postcard. They get a dog cookie right down to our lower lobby dog spa, if you would believe, with Jaga Dog treadmills. His and her bathrooms, canine loo as I like to call it, separated so everyone's happy.
Wait. Stop right there. The doggy bathrooms?
Yeah.
What is inside the dog? Is this a patch of grass?
Well, it's actually, there's sawdust there so they can go, and some bags to pick it up, and it's sectioned off so everyone's happy. And the dogs go there. They don't have to go outside because, you know, in snowstorms, whether it's salt or some items on the ground, you don't want the dog to get anything in their foot.
I've heard reports that there's sometimes a competition among owners as who has the most spoiled dog. What's the most outrageous request you've gotten for a dog?
You know what? It's been food requests. We don't have room service, but the odd time I help an owner in need, there's been orders for five cheeseburgers with no onions, chicken sandwiches, meatballs with extra tomato sauce.
It can't be good.
Really? That's not good for the dogs.
Well, you know what they say? They actually say it's good for their coat. They're good for their hair. I wish it was the same for me.
That you got to eat that way, right?
That's right.
So there's actually a lot of paparazzi at the hotel as well. Are they interfering with the regular guests?
No, you know what? The dogs are used to it, and I like to call them paparazzi. You know, everything's a pun nowadays, so it's a paparazzi.
Oh, Jerry Grimek, I'm not sure we can allow you to get away with that.
I talked to my director of marketing about this.
Oh, no, Jerry. You've been at this job way too long.
And it's actually, the dogs look forward to it because they're almost little models themselves, and they love the attention. It helps boost their spirit.
I'm sure the dogs love attention. All dogs love attention. Do you have to hire extra staff for things like scooping duty?
No, believe it or not, these dogs are on good behavior as soon as they arrive because they know that everyone's watching them. They don't want any points against them. And in fact, the hotel looks forward to it every year because we are pet-friendly year-round at Hotel Pennsylvania.
Yeah, this is a little bit too much of treating the dogs like humans for me, Jerry. I'm getting hives here. Jerry Grimek is the doggy concierge at New York's Hotel Pennsylvania. He's in charge of greeting dogs for the Westminster Dog Show. Thanks, Jerry.
No problem. Have a good one.
We're running our own dog show here at The Takeaway. You can enter your dog in it. Send us a picture. You have until 10 a.m. Eastern today, and then the voting begins. You can check out the competition while you're at it. That's at thetakeaway.org. We're going to post them onto our Facebook page. There's instructions for all of that at thetakeaway.org. Todd, you don't have a dog, right?
No. I don't know why we have all these wags on the air, to be honest.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week, and I'm here with Celeste Headlee, of course. Coming up, when health studies contradict, whom do you believe, and how does it affect your family? We talk about families every Monday, and today we're focusing on autism and how to separate fact from fiction in that murky, murky area of medical science. That's in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. U.S. Marines are pushing deeper into the city of Marja in Afghanistan. It's day three of the offensive to root out the Taliban and protect civilians in the city. In the past hour, the top NATO commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, has been giving a news conference. He said NATO forces are working closely with their Afghan counterparts.
When President Karzai approved the conduct of this operation, he gave us some very specific guidance. And that guidance was to continue to protect the people of Afghanistan. And so this operation has been done with that in mind.
National Security Advisor Jim Jones spoke on Fox News yesterday. He said the new strategy in Afghanistan to protect the population centers and reinstall Afghan government control is essential to eventually getting American troops out.
There is a new direction, there's new commitment, and that we're going to be successful.
There has been a major train crash in Belgium today. At least 25 people are now known to have been killed in the rush hour collision of two commuter trains in Brussels. No word yet on the cause of the crash. And today in international business, ticket prices for transatlantic flights could be affected by a newly approved alliance between American Airlines, British Airlines, and Iberia Airlines. The U.S. Department of Transportation has given their One World Alliance antitrust immunity. We have details now from BBC business reporter Rodney Smith. He joins us from London. Good morning, Rodney.
Hi, Celeste.
Okay, so if you search a one-way flight from New York to London, it's about $435. So after this deal is done, am I going to pay more or less for that flight?
Well, first of all, the deal's quite a long way away yet. It's not happened. And the Europeans still have to decide if they're going to go ahead with this. But you're quite right. The whole point really is about the effect that it has on people flying between New York, London, or New York, Paris, or whatever, from between the States and between Europe. And at the moment, it's unlikely to have an impact. But over time, say the airlines, there will be economies of scale which will allow costs to come down. But critics say, of course, that that's all very well. But there could have been 9 airlines here instead of what we see now, which is essentially 3 alliances. And that means the competition is less. And so prices could be higher.
So they've given this One World Alliance antitrust immunity. Is this something that consumers should be outraged about?
They didn't give antitrust immunity 10 years ago when it was first applied for, so we have to wonder what happened in the interim. They've required that BA give up some of the these very lucrative airline
That's
slots
British at Airways.
Heathrow. That's right, British Airways. They're having to give up 4 slots. This is a very technical issue, and you have to wonder what sort of pressure was put on the regulators that they decided to let this come through like this.
Okay, Rodney Smith is the business reporter for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from London. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
New studies are released and retracted all the time on what causes autistic spectrum disorder and what quote-unquote cures it. For example, in the last 2 weeks, the British medical journal The Lancet retracted the frequently cited Wakefield study from 1998, which linked MMR vaccine, that's measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, to autism. Now, just a few days later, the journal Autism Research published a study saying that advanced maternal and paternal age, that's the age of mom and dad, is a risk factor for autism. So what's true and what isn't? We want to spend a little time trying to get down into the data on autism and make it a little simpler. We want to give you a little bit of a crib sheet here on what we know about autism and what we don't know. Dr. Perry Klass and Dr. Eileen Costello are both pediatricians and co-authors of Quirky Kids. Dr. Klass is here in the studio with me. Dr. Klass, autistic spectrum disorder is sort of the catch-all phrase. And the term autism is really hard to understand because it's not just one thing. It may not even be just 5 things. Can you help us understand exactly what is autism in a way that isn't too overwhelming to even understand for us?
Well, it's a complicated term, and it's a complicated spectrum. And I think one of the things that you bring up in what you said initially is just our understanding that it is a spectrum, that it's not one very specific disorder, that it's a whole spectrum of behaviors and levels of function. That's kind of new. That wasn't around when wasn't around when I was in medical school, let alone when I was a child.
Characterized by what? A couple of instances of the behaviors or the problems that identify this.
There is a communication issue, both a social communication issue in terms of understanding other people's social cues and social signals. There can be very specific communication considerations in terms of how children use speech and language and how language develops. There is a whole range of issues then that come up around repetitive acts and very special interests and even obsessional interests. There's an interplay of these different traits that mark people on the autism spectrum. I just want to comment on one other thing before you say. You say new studies are introduced and retracted all the time. In fact, that retraction that you mentioned by The Lancet was a pretty unusual event and probably has something to do with why we're having this conversation.
Probably does. Well, all of these behaviors and these difficulties that kids have that you're describing, as complicated as they are, all translate to really difficult parenting. Or they can.
Absolutely.
Because these kids can be difficult to parent. Dr. Costello, I want to bring you in. I have a list in front of me of a lot of causes or supposed causes of autism. We've heard all of these, but they're really complicated. And I thought you might go down the list and just help us understand how much of this is true. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. Vaccines. They're definitely off the table as a cause now?
Yes.
Off the table.
And that is a wonderful thing. As a primary care pediatrician, I think the Wakefield study that Dr. Klass was just referring to really caused a lot of fear and panic around the world and caused a lot of parents to have anxiety about immunizing their children. And it's a real blessing that the paper was retracted, because I think that research dollars were diverted in order to disprove that theory that could have been used for more important things.
Okay, let's get down the list here a little bit. Vaccines off the table. Environmental factors, heavy metals like lead and mercury.
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think the mercury question is also a vaccine question, because I think when the MMR vaccine came off the table, the idea that something in vaccines must be causing this problem gained some strength. And I think we're pretty clear that it's certainly not the mercury-based preservatives in vaccines. And even the children who are exposed to very high levels of mercury don't actually manifest autistic symptoms.
Okay,
so I think we're pretty sure that's not the problem either.
Okay, I don't want to keep you too short, but we have a long list and there's so many questions about this. Viruses that can affect pregnant women, like influenza and herpes, do they have a role?
There is some data to suggest that viral infections in pregnancy can increase your rates of developmental disorders, including autism.
Now, we had this study last week that we mentioned, age of mom and dad, older age increases your risk. What do we know about that?
Yes, I think that theory's been around for a long time, and there is growing data that advanced parental age is a risk factor.
Okay, that it could be. Dr. Klass, we've talked about some of the causes of autism. What about cures, or so-called cures? We've heard about gluten-free and dairy-free diets. A lot of this stuff seems to be trial and error.
A lot of this stuff is trial and error, and when you talk about the burdens that autism places on parents, some of these more extreme diets place an even greater burden on parents. Obviously, different things parents feel help with different children. The idea of a cure for autism is not really something we talk about. We talk about this as whether the child gets relief or help with the things that get in the way, with the things that make that child's life difficult. And there's no evidence around those diets, especially the more extreme diets.
So you're talking about behavioral help and help with the difficulties of behavior and parenting, not necessarily high-dose vitamins or things like chelation therapy, which is where they go in and try to suck the lead and the mercury out.
And which is actually dangerous and has been known to kill a child. No, we're talking
oxygen chambers and things like that.
I think the really basic message, and I bet Dr. Costello would agree with me about this, is that the behavioral therapies, and especially when you start them early, the more intense behavioral therapies are showing up as really effective. And for that, there really are data. And therefore, that urge to get children looked at and diagnosed earlier rather than later and get them help early is where a lot of our attention and effort should be going.
All right. So that's attention on behavior and helping with the difficult behaviors of autism. That's Dr. Perry Klass, primary care physician and Science Times writer. And we're also joined by Dr. Eileen Costello, primary care pediatrician and co-author of Quirky Kids. There are 5 myths about autism. You can see them on our website, thetakeaway.org, for more information.
We're also following the Winter Olympics all this morning. It got off to a sad start when an athlete died during practice on Friday. And we're looking for your takeaway here. Are the Olympics getting too fast? Are they too extreme? Are they too dangerous? Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Also, you have until 10 a.m. Eastern to post your photo of your dog on our website for our Best in Show competition at The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry all week. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.